as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
Welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine, California, and on the World Wide Web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. And before I announce our guest, I want to tell you I have a pair of tickets for you. Ray Charles at the Grove of Anaheim tomorrow night. If you're interested, email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net. And the first person who emails will get the tickets, free tickets. Ray Charles, I wish I could go. Anyway, today my guest is Susan Strait. She has published 5 novels, Aqua Boogie, I've Been in Sorrow's Kitchen and Looked Out All the Pots, which was named one of the best novels of 1992 by both USA Today and Publishers Weekly, and it was named a notable book by the New York Times. Blacker Than a Thousand Midnights, The Gettin' Place, and her most recent book, High Wire Moon, which was a National Book Award finalist last year and won the Commonwealth of California Gold Medal for fiction. High Wire Moon was a San Francisco Chronicle bestseller and was named one of the year's best novels by the San Francisco Chronicle and the Washington Post. Susan Strait has published essays and articles in numerous magazines and journals, such as the New York Times Magazine, the Los Angeles Times Magazine, Harper's, Reader's Digest, Family Circle, Westway, Salon, and the Ruminator Review, as well as short stories in Story, Tri-Quarterly, Plowshares, the Ontario Review, North American Review, and I believe she's in this month's Zoetrope. She was born in Riverside, California, and still lives there with her 3 daughters. And before I bring her on, I must say that the opinions and views you hear today are those of my guest and me, and not the University of Regents. Hi, Susan.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Great to have you. Gosh, this book, High Wire Moon, is quite something. It's dealing with migrant workers. It's dealing with a side of California that you don't often see in fiction. And I'm curious what attracted you to the theme, to the characters, to writing this book.
Well, it is true that my sort of fictional postage stamp of soil, like Faulkner said, is Rio Seco. I mean, I have lived in Riverside all my life. But this book, actually, I began when I was 19 years old. And I had friends who'd picked oranges, and I'd grown up in the orange groves and knew a lot of people whose parents picked oranges. And they didn't speak Spanish. They spoke Mixtec, which sounded completely different. I mean, it sounded closer almost to Swahili.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd heard them speaking, and I was always curious about what part of Mexico they came from. And so I'd sort of been thinking about that, but when I was 19, I heard a story about a group of women who were deported from a linen plant near my house. It was right at the across the orange groves from my house. And I always wondered what happened to their kids.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they left their kids maybe with a neighbor or a relative, and then the mothers just never came home. And, you know, if you're in a car accident, someone comes to your house and says, you know, what happened to you? Or even if you're arrested, someone
yes.
comes to the house. But when you're deported, you just disappear. So that's where I got the idea for writing about this mother and daughter separated in an immigration raid. And my mother was a foster mom. So that's where I got the idea to have the little girl go into foster care.
The first chapter was so painful, where Serafina is taken in, and her baby Elvia is left in the car in a bush, essentially, and then it jumps on from there quite into later years. Well, the girl's a teenager when we, I guess, go into the second chapter, but that was so painful to read, and I wonder what that was like to write.
It's a good question, because, you know, it's even hard for me to read it. And I have to confess to you, that's where I began. I wrote that part when I was 19.
Hmm.
It's always hard, especially when you teach writing, as I do, and when you go around and speak about writing, because people think, well, how could you write something when you were 19 and then not want to change much of it?
Yeah.
And I don't know what happened to me that night. I was sitting in a parked car, writing it, you know, with a pencil and my notebook, and I went to this church parking lot, and I sat in front of this statue, and I knew what was going to happen to Serafina, to this woman. And I still have that notebook. I mean, that's one of the few virtues of living like three blocks from where you were born. I still have all my notebooks. I still have all my clothes from the trade. But I wrote it by hand, and I wrote about the statue and the sirens and her trying to get back to the car, which was around the corner of the church. And I wrote the part about Elvia waking up when she was three in this car and then going into foster care. And it wasn't that my mom abandoned me when I was three, but I don't know. I knew exactly how the station wagon felt and how she felt waking up. And that was a very strange thing to write, but it is kind of scary.
So you started this 20 years ago, and what happened? You put it down, you worked on other books. What happened to it that you left it to return to it later?
You know, I don't know. I mean, again, we talk about writing all the time, don't we? We say, write what you know. And somehow I knew the first 50 pages. And I even wrote Larry's part. He's the wild and
yes.
crazy American guy that Serafina hooks up with. So Elvia is half crazy American guy and half Mixtec Indian. And that guy was based on someone like my brother. But my brother was 10 times wilder than the guy in the novel. So I wrote that for first 50 pages. And then, truthfully, I didn't know what Serafina would do. I mean, I was 19 years old. I didn't have any kids yet. All my friends were already having kids. And I thought, well, what will she risk to come back over the border and get her child? But I wasn't sure what she would risk at that point. So I did. I put it aside, and I thought, this is a story that's too scary even for me to write right now. And I wrote the stories in Akwaboogie, and I wrote those other novels, and I kept coming back after each book thinking, now I'm ready to write about Serafina again. And I wasn't, not until I was 35. So then I spent another 2 years finishing it. And I guess after I had three kids and I knew maybe how desperate she would feel. And I'd gone to Oaxaca. I got a Guggenheim Fellowship to go to Oaxaca and do some research for the book. And my middle child got really sick in Oaxaca, and all these women helped me there. And then I think I knew how Serafina would feel.
Hmm.
So.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest today is Susan Strait, author of Highwire Moon, published by Houghton Mifflin. Larry is an interesting character because he is kind of gnarly, but he's very, there's something sympathetic about him.
Yeah, Larry, truthfully, I was afraid to put Larry in the book. So, you know, all those handwritten pages I mentioned, when I finished the first draft of this book and it was sold to Houghton Mifflin and I talked to my editor for the first time, there was no Larry, there was no Larry's point of view. I mean, Larry himself was in it. And she said, boy, this Larry's a fascinating character. She said, I mean, you don't know anybody like him, do you? And I was like, yeah. And she said, I mean, you don't hang around with anyone like this, do you? And I was like, yeah. Every day I'm only related to someone like that. And she said, well, why not have his point of view? And I thought it would be way too scary. And I mean, Barbara, that was really hard to write. His sections are so brief. He's using methamphetamine and he's searching for his daughter and even the sentences were so different for me. So I was really scared when I turned in those pages that she'd asked for. And she called back and said, he's my favorite character in the book. And I was so surprised. And then now having gone around the country and done a lot of readings, and I'm still shocked how many people come up to me and say, I like Larry. And you know what I think? I think it's because he has this sort of unswerving devotion to his daughter.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's not that he's giving her the right food, but he's giving her her favorite foods, which I guess shows us
right
how much he loves her. And he grew up in foster care, and he's so determined that she's not going to grow up with strangers. And I guess I like that about him, too.
Mm-hmm. Will you read to us?
Yeah, I think I will read the part where Elvie wakes up in the car.
Okay.
It is kind of scary, but she wakes up in the car, and her mom is gone, and she's 3 years old.
Okay.
And Ma dove in and out of the streetlight beam, banging against the window near Elvia, then veering away in bursts of blurry white. Branches and leaves covered the windshield, pressed tight like a blanket of black knives. Elvia wasn't to touch knives. Her mother used knives to take the spines off the green cactus pads. They could eat the cactus then. But her father had gotten angry when he saw the cactus today. He had thrown the keys at her mother and shouted, "Get a life!" Once Elvia had gotten spines embedded in her finger, and her mother had pulled out the tiny red needles with her teeth. Elvia studied the red circle of burn on her wrist. Her mother had kissed the burn. Elvia licked it herself. Her mother would lick it and cool it again when she came back. The crickets resumed their shrill scraping in the black leaves all around the car. She had awakened in the front seat. Her mother was gone. The keys were gone. Her father had thrown the keys today, flying with silver wings and landing on her mother's chest. And Echinae, where was her mother? Her father, where was their mother? The silver knob had turned fire red and her mother had taken it away. Her mother's lips were red as the glowing circle. The moths bumped harder against the glass, and Elvia peered out the window to see them dancing crazily in the light, dipping in and out of darkness. She saw the parking lot empty and gray as if she were inside a cloud. Viko nu'u, her mother always said, pointing up at the clouds. Her mother. Elvia was afraid now, and she ducked down into the cave under the dashboard. The well of space was warm, just the right size when she drew her legs to her chest. The floor felt like evening sidewalk against her legs. She twisted her braid into a pillow for her head. She could smell her mother's cinnamon. Something pale bumped the other window then, harder, harder, and she looked up. The sky was light. The moths were gone. A pair of white hands pressed like a snail's underside against the glass, around a wide face bright as the moon. Elvia screamed and screamed, when the man opened the door. She screamed while he pulled her out and carried her away. Then she was quiet, and she didn't open her mouth for months. Where is your mother? The man kept asking. Then a woman asked, where is your mother, your father? Behind her glasses, the woman's eyes were huge and dark as plums. Her hair was a nest of yellow. She touched Elvia's hair and said, pretty braid. Elvia pulled away. She said inside her head, Lasu. The woman touched her fingers and said, little hands. Elvia put them under her legs. She said inside her head, Indaha. The woman put her in a car.
Thank you. If you just tuned in, you were listening to Susan Strait read from Highwire Moon, a novel that was released last year and is now coming out in paperback. Oh, boy. How do you keep from getting too overly emotional when you're writing scenes like this, or do you get too overly emotional?
I wish I could confess to you that, you know, yes, this is just a job, and we sit at the typewriter or the keyboard, and we don't feel anything, but no, it made me, that was really hard when I wrote it in that parked car so long ago when I was 19, and then, well, just last week, I was working on my new novel, and I actually called my agent, and I told him, this is really scary, this is so scary, I have stomachache now, and I need to get up and walk around and go have a cup of tea. And he was very quiet. I think he was kind of appalled. He was thinking like, oh, well, that's going to be great to sell. It's so scary. It's making her sick. And she's writing it. I mean, I guess we should be emotionally invested, but I'm not sure why I always write such scary stuff. But that part, it was frightening to me. And it was frightening to me that Serafina had gotten dragged away. And I can't say that I didn't feel anything when I wrote it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. There are parts of it where I liked it and it was funny and I enjoyed describing the landscape or whatever, and then there were parts of it that were really scary and I had to get up and walk around the house in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my kids come out and they're like, what's going on? It's 2 a.m. We thought somebody was breaking in, and they're like, no, just working on a scary part of the book, guys. And they're looking at me like, what a freak. They go back to bed. I can't imagine what they tell their friends in the morning.
Oh, that's funny. Well, you know, ideas, because you do all sorts of things. You write short stories, you write novels, you write essays, you do pieces on the NPR. How do you know what's what? What becomes a short story? What becomes a novel? Is there some way you figure it out, or does it just come that way and you know this is an idea for a novel? Is it
hardly anybody ever asks a writer that, I think. I mean, look at Joyce Carol Oates, one of my favorite writers.
Mm-hmm.
And she just wrote her first young adult novel.
Yes.
And I can't wait to read it. I've heard it's remarkable. For me, there's a completely different sort of feeling. I mean, when I write an essay, it has to be something I'm kind of passionate about. Like when I wrote last year, I wrote a piece for the LA Times called Bubble Wrapping Baby, and it started because they wrapped up all the playgrounds at school with yellow tape. And I thought, again, of how sad it was that our kids can't really do some of the things we did. And I mean, I felt passionate about it, but in a completely different way from something I'm writing about for a novel. And the short story that's in Zoetrope, that was something that I started 3 or 4 times and came back to. It's about a correctional officer who's a woman and who gets her nephew at the prison where she works. And I wrote that because I was so sad to see a lot of my nieces and nephews being incarcerated, and I didn't know what to do about it, and I felt really sad about it, and so that's when I write fiction. Normally it's something that's really scary to me or very sad, and I'm not quite sure. It's something I don't even think I can fix. Somehow when I write an essay, I have this, you know, I'm sure it's a misguided notion that I'm going to get it out on paper and maybe even read it on NPR or whatever, and that I'll feel better about it, or that somebody will say, hey, that's true. I felt the same way, but fiction is so much more private and scary.
Interesting. And does long fiction then feel different to you from short fiction? When something occurs to you, do you just know where it goes? You know this has the breadth and depth to become a novel, and this is a short story.
Yeah, the short story. I've only written, I'm confessing, I've only written 4 short stories in the last 3 years. And that's mostly because I become obsessed with these novels. And I mean, for me, I have 3 kids and I have a, you know, full-time teaching job and I write at night. And so when I'm immersed in a novel like I am right now in the one I'm working on, it's a big comfort to me, even though it's scary and bleak. I mean, I'm writing about scary stuff again. But it's a comfort to me somehow. My kids go to bed and, you know, the dishwasher's going and the washing machine and the dryer and I sit down and there's all that humming noise, and I'm in a completely different world, and it's dark, and my neighborhood's not the safest, and, you know, somebody might be throwing glass outside or breaking something, but I'm there in front of the computer, and I'm in this completely other world. I'm in the orange groves, or I'm in the eucalyptus trees, or I'm fighting fires, like in Blacker Than a Thousand Midnights, and that's something I want to be able to do for a whole year.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Where
mm-hmm.
I'm going to go into a complete other world, and this is going to make me sound like a horrible mother. You're going to finish this talk with me calling Child Protective Services on me. I mean, I'm driving in the car with the kids, and it's not that I'm not paying attention to the road. I'm paying attention, but if they're quiet and they're talking to themselves, I'm thinking about Elvia. mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about what she's doing, or I'll hear a song and I'm completely in that world too. And during the day, I like to be somewhere else. And Toni Morrison gave an interview once where she talked about sort of this scrim. It was almost like a scrim of water between her and her children sometimes. Not in a bad way, but that's just sort of the way our brains work maybe when we're writers. So I felt better after I read that. I mean, it's not that I'm not paying complete attention when we're doing the seven biomes and the taiga and the tundra and the rainforest and all that. But
yes.
At the same time, then at night when I'm by myself, I want to be into something for a year and a half.
Hmm.
Hope that doesn't sound crazy, but short fiction is a completely different proposition. And an essay is something that would engage me for a week or two. But a novel is something I want to be passionate about for a long time.
How much do you know about your novels before you begin? Do you start with characters? Do you have a situation that you want to explore? Is it a feeling? What is it?
Well, with High Water Moon, it was definitely that really strange thing where I'd heard about those women, and I, you know, there I was living out in the orange groves and seeing people pick oranges, and, you know, I was that young impressionable 19, and I just became obsessed with this mother and daughter being separated. I think I was missing my foster sister as well. She had lived with us for a long time, most of my childhood, and then when she turned 16, she left. And maybe that's what it was, too, but it was the characters. I had this in mind, this woman who'd met this crazy man when she was working at a linen plant, and immigration came, and he saved her by holding open a box. And she crawled into the box, and he put the box in the back of his truck, and he drove away. And then I thought, well, how did that happen? And what happened once he got home and she couldn't even speak Spanish? And then I imagined that, you know, they fell in together for a brief time and they had this baby. But I began it at that statue where the baby and the mother were already separated. And I had to work backwards.
Hmm.
So, I mean, I knew a lot about them beforehand, but I was kind of in that really weird stage that maybe some writers will tell you. You're sort of walking around all the time. I remember when I was married, my poor husband worked graveyard shift. And so he'd be sleeping between 8 and midnight. And I was supposed to be typing and he would wake up. I would wake him up to go to work. And he'd say, I didn't hear you typing. I thought you were going to work. And I'd say, well, I was working. And he's like, well, I didn't hear you typing. And I'm like, yeah, I was walking around thinking about the people. And he's like, well, that's not work. What kind of work is that? You're walking around thinking. And I want him to say, well, that's what I'm doing. You know, that's work. And then when I was in graduate school and met James Baldwin, he said that's the most important part. It's the gestational period of your novel. You're walking around thinking about the characters. So I was like, see? This is really important, this whole silence. Yes, this not typing. I'm really making money here. I am.
Talk about working with James Baldwin. I think that is just incredible and wonderful. What was that like?
It was. It was something, I mean, for someone like me from Riverside, and I'd lived here all my life, and I was already married, and we went off to Massachusetts, and it was cold, and my poor ex-husband was freezing, and he was working in a group home for juvenile delinquents, and working graveyard, and I was writing at night, and then I took this class with James Baldwin, and I did feel transformed in a sense, because he would say things like that. He would say, well, of course, the most important part is when you're not typing, it's when you're walking around thinking, and no one ever let you think about stuff like that.
Mm.
And then he would look at my story, and he would say, you know, I really think the heart of this story is when this character's at work. And that's all he would say, and I would go home, and I would think, what is he talking about? That's a really minor scene in this short story. But he was right. When I got back to Riverside and I kept all his words kind of like treasures in the back of my mind, I rewrote that particular short story and I sent it off to Tri-Quarterly, and it was the very first story I ever got accepted. And the editor, Reginald Gibbons, someone I admired a lot, he wrote back and said, yeah, it's the scenes at work that really make this story. And I thought, oh, well, that's why he's James Baldwin and I'm not, because he knows everything. And he was very quiet. It was only, you know, 5 years before he died. He was very quiet, but he would be able to say the right thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then my other professor, Jay Nugelborn, he's the one who taught me how to line edit. You know, he said, take this apart line by line. What has to stay and what can be cut? And now cutting is my favorite part of the entire enterprise. I like to go through a story or an essay and see what I can cut out.
Mm.
So between the two of them, I was very lucky.
Was graduate school an important, really important part of becoming a writer? Do you think you could have kind of done the same thing if you had just, say, gone off to a cabin for a couple of years to write and maybe met with writers once in a while?
I know this is a big debate, especially as I'm now starting a new, I just started a new graduate program here. I have a new MFA program. This is a huge debate that I hear over and over, and I read about it for me, I would have never, ever have been able to become a writer had not it been for graduate school. I mean, look, I came from a completely non-academic background. Many of my friends now still are illiterate. I hang out most of the time with people who don't read at all. A lot of them can't. And so, I mean, I graduated from high school just barely. I went off to USC. I was a sports writer. And when I was a senior at USC, I took these fiction writing classes, and T.C. Boyle read one of my stories. I had never taken a class with him. I was afraid of him. And he said, this is a great story. You should be going off to graduate school. Here's the places you should apply. And I was so kind of him. I mean, here I was a total stranger. But if I had not gone to graduate school, I would have gone straight back home. Within 2 years, 20 of my friends were dead or in prison. I would have never known how to take apart a story line by line. I would have never met another writer. So for me, graduate school was, it was what made me into what I am now. I learned how to read. I learned how to think about a story, not just on the gut level, but how to take it apart. I read Louise Erdrich. I read Love Medicine and thought, hey, wait a minute, she's writing about people that I can write about. I read people like Andrea Lee. I read short stories. I read The New Yorker. I'd never seen The New Yorker in my life until I got to college and graduate school. Hmm. So for me, it was a pivotal experience.
It was big.
Yeah, it was very big. I didn't even know. Here I was in graduate school, and I had spent the summer at home hanging around with my in my neighborhood, and I got to graduate school, and I still said things like, we shouldn't have went over there. People were looking at me like, what are you talking about? And in graduate school, I got scared too, Barbara. I mean, workshop was a very scary thing for me because people said, so what's with all the working class background? I didn't even know what working class was. I said, I don't know. And then I went home and I tried to look up working class. I had no idea that that was a bad thing. I didn't know there was a leisure class. I mean, in my neighborhood, if you had a job, this was a really good thing. Okay? If you were not working class, you were like homeless. So I couldn't even tell you how scary workshop was, and that was really good for me. Mm. Because writing stories and then sending them out to publications, that's a scary thing. People are not going to be nice to you.
Yeah.
I needed to practice.
Mm. When we come back, I want to ask you a bunch of things, but I want to ask you to tell us about the graduate program at UC Riverside. So let's take a very short break, and we'll be right back with more Susan Strait. So don't go away.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine, California. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is Susan Strait, author of High Wire Moon. We have winners for Ray Charles tickets. Trista Thompson won a pair, and so did Darlene Hard and Sandra Gervis, who will all be going to see Ray Charles tomorrow night. And I want to be there, but I can't. So anyway, let's bring Susan back. Tell us about the UC Riverside program.
UC Riverside, where I've taught for 14 years now, and where it's kind of embarrassing because I actually grew up like playing on the campus. I grew up across the street.
That's so great.
Rough neighborhood. So we have a bell tower, and I climbed it from the outside when I was 9. That wasn't a good thing. The police came and got me down. But anyway, I like working here, and I love our students here. And we had a lot of students who were going to UC Irvine. We've had 3 of my best favorite students were in the graduate program with you at UC Irvine. And I wanted to start something because a lot of the students around here are parents and can't travel, and they're not going to be able to move out of state. And I also wanted to start something different. We have the creative writing and writing for the performing arts MFA, so people can take poetry and screenwriting. You can do 2 genres, or you could do fiction and memoir. We have fiction, creative nonfiction, poetry, screenwriting, and playwriting, so people can take any combination of those. And in the first class, we have actually 3/4 of the people are parents.
Interesting.
Yeah, and then what's funny is, I don't know, everyone says, you know, I'm proud of where I live, but I really am proud of this area of the Inland Empire. And so we have some students applying from Croatia and from San Diego and from L.A. A lot of our students, though, are from places like Fontana, Bloomington, and Orange County. So we have a really good first crop.
Interesting. Oh, boy.
More writing programs. That's
more writing programs, but that's a good thing.
It'll be the 909, the Blink 182 of writing programs. That's our big joke.
Oh, that's great, though. But yeah, as you were saying earlier, there is the debate about, is it better to go through a writing program where conceivably everybody has to sort of write alike to be accepted by each other, or to write to a certain denominator, or to just go off and write?
Yeah, I think what I tell my students, and a lot of them are older, too. I have 4 of the students are in their 40s. And I say, you know what? I mean, this is going to be 2 years where you're going to have workshop settings where people are going to talk to you about your work, and then everybody knows whether you've published 5 novels or 50 or none. Then you have to go sit in front of the typewriter or the keyboard. We're all the same, don't you think? At the end of the evening, mm-hmm. It doesn't matter whether we're in graduate school or whether we've never been to graduate school or whether we've already published or not, we all have to sit in front of the keyboard.
Yeah.
We all have exactly the same job. And that's how I feel every night when I sit down.
Is that when you work late at night?
Yeah, it's always late at night.
Now, is that because...
I'm getting older, though. I used to be able to stay up till 4 in the morning. Now I'm 41, so, you know, 1 o'clock rolls around and I'm pretty tired. I don't even drink coffee. I drink tea.
And is that so, you know, you take care of your kids and your life, you know, your sort of awake life, your daily life, and then when the kids go to bed, it's time for you?
It's because as much as I love teaching, that's what I do in the day. And then, yeah, I mean, at 3 o'clock, I pick up kids and everybody's got basketball practice or something, and everyone has homework, and being a single mom, that there's just me, and there's the laundry. The laundry is really quite a zen thing. So actually, if I put them to bed and then I go in the laundry room, no one comes out because they don't want to help me fold laundry or anything. So I stay in there for a safe period of 20 minutes or so. Then no one will come out. Then they go to sleep. But truthfully, I live in a really wild neighborhood, too, so if I try to write during the day, I don't know, there's always like a car accident or...
Now, why have you stayed in that neighborhood?
I don't know.
Well, I only say that because, you know, it just seems like most writers, as soon as they can, they sort of leave wherever they live, wherever they were brought up, wherever, you know, wherever.
They're smarter than I am. I don't know. You know what? I know. I'm just being silly. I got a big family here. I mean, I do. I live 3 blocks from where I was born, and it is a crazy neighborhood sometimes. I have this guy named Doug that comes around and borrows money from me at the end of every month. And he's in a wheelchair and his feet are being amputated. And he's, you know what? I always have like $11 or something and I'll give it to him. And he always brings it back to me on the 5th of the month after I get this check. I mean, I'm the bank. I don't know why I stay. I just do because my kids have always lived in the same house and there's like, you know, 100 family members around us. And there is a support system there. I mean, if I get really desperate, we all help each other out.
And you're the one, apparently, that the neighbors come to when they need help, writing
I'm
a
La
letter.
Vieja.
Or...
At age 41, they call me La Vieja. I'm the old lady of the neighborhood. Isn't that sad? I've been there forever. I don't know what it is. And also, you know, they're all those cousins, and they're all my nieces and nephews. I have 25 nieces and nephews and 4 great-nieces and nephews, and so each niece and nephew gets $500 for me to go to college. So, you know, I kind of have to stay around for that. There's a lot of them still around. Trying to go to college.
Oh, you're Saint Susan.
No, I'm not Saint Susan. I'm just, you know, I got an old car, so.
Well, I don't know.
I want everybody to.
These are great stories. I love hearing about your life.
It's definitely not Saint Susan when I'm doing the laundry. Okay, you can feel better about that. I'm definitely in there saying things to the laundry.
Well, you do wonderful things with Riverside, actually, because I've seen your work in Westways where. You know, you're writing about Riverside or even, you know, the windmills on the way to Palm Springs. And it's really, your nonfiction is as wonderful as your fiction, really.
Oh, thank you. But I have to confess to you that I heard myself on NPR last night and I was mopping the floor. I was mopping the floor. But I was talking about our whole idea of fall, which is where you get to put 3 tumbleweeds together and spray paint them white and you put a hat on them and that's our snowman. We have lots of tumbleweeds out here. You got to do something with that.
You know, last night when we talked, you brought up Grapes of Wrath and Required Reading and Migrant Workers. Will you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. I had a student in today, and she's from San Diego, and we both just happened to see the same thing on the news this morning, which was a field of crosses that had to do with all the people who have died trying to cross the border this year. And it's around 280 people. And for our counties, you know, Riverside, Imperial, San Diego, Orange County, these are the counties that people get to first. And Grapes of Wrath, you know, won the California Book Award when it came out. And it was talking about migrant workers, and it's now our state reading choice, the entire state of California. We are meant in the month of October to be reading the Grapes of Wrath. And so when I won the California Book Award for this book, it just struck me that we were both writing about the same things, you know, decades apart. People are still dying crossing the border basically to do exactly the same thing the Joads did. You know, they had hungry kids.
Yeah.
You remember those Dorothy Lange folks,
oh,
don't
sure.
you, of the women
yeah.
with their hands cupped around their faces? And I can't tell you, my kids go to a school that's half bilingual, and probably a quarter of the kids in our neighborhood school have parents who have just gotten here from Mexico in the last year and a half or so. And I can't tell you how many women stand in front of the cafeteria watching their kids eat lunch, and they have their hands cupped around their faces in exactly that same, you know, their knuckles are slightly bent, and they're watching their children eat breakfast. And I know this is a big debate where people are saying, you know, there are too many people coming. But, I mean, I have 3 kids. If somebody said to me I couldn't feed them, I would walk 100 miles to feed them.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote about people picking oranges because that's where it still happens out here, is people are picking oranges and grapes and strawberries. And in the novel, Elvia takes off to go look for her mother, as she said, when she's a teenager, and she ends up picking grapes for a few days in Mecca. And she has no idea how hard that is. And then later on in the novel, Serafina has crossed the border to try to find Elvia, and she's picking oranges in Rio Seco. And my brother lived out in the orange groves for many, many years. He was a caretaker of 18 acres of oranges, and he had told me so many stories. He picked his own oranges, my brother did. He didn't own the land, he just worked it. But he had told me so many stories of guys running through his grove. And then he also told me stories about guys that spent an entire week picking oranges, and on the last day, the foreman would call the INS, and they'd all be rounded up, and that way he wouldn't have to pay them. And then he'd go get a new crew the next Monday.
Mm.
And I never forgot those stories either.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today, Susan Strait, author of High Wire Moon. A while ago, you talked about revision and with a lovely sort of tone to your voice, as if you love it.
What a strange thing.
Will you talk a bit more about revision and sort of your relationship with revision?
Well, when I began, you know, writing early on, and especially like when I started this book when I was 19, I mean, my favorite thing to write were those long passages of description. You know, we love that, the lush description, and get to use all our metaphors and things. But you realize that when you get to be 41 and you're reading at night, what's going to keep you moving is some kind of narrative flow as well. And as much as I still love all the, those are my favorite things. I don't have a writer's workshop. I just have one best friend, and I send her all my work. I've sent her every page I've ever written. She's the only person reading my new novel now. We went to graduate school together, Barbara, as a matter of fact. That's the one great thing about graduate school is I think you meet somebody, hopefully you meet that one person that you will send your work to for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And I mean, here I am out in, you know, where I am with friends who don't read, so I send all my work to my best friend, Holly. And she's really funny because she'll always say to me, you need to cut this because you must be hungry. And what she means is I'll have all this lush description and everything's like as green as boiled cabbage or tight as a burrito, and she'll actually write on the page, go get a snack, okay? So, I mean, for me, revision is going through the novel or even the essay and finding all that dead wood that I had to get on the page just to know what these characters were doing. But I really like to be able to get rid of it. And the editor I work with at NPR has been really helpful. One of my favorite things is to sit in front of the computer, and she's on the phone, and I'm on the phone, and she's like, let's cut 100 words out of this. Doesn't that sound sadistic? But to me, it's wonderful because you actually see what can go, and then you see this really spare, elegant kind of writing. I mean, I really admire Jean Reese. That's one of my favorite writers. It's just very concise and spare and elegant. And as I started out when I was in my 20s, everything seemed very long, and every story was 25 pages, and, you know, I did. I wrote 400-page 500-page novels, and now I really like that idea of something being supple and concise. So a lot of what ends up going, I would say, are my favorite descriptions. Doesn't that sound horrible? A lot of what goes, it might be a conversation with someone who turns out to be extraneous, but I had to have the character have that conversation with that person in order to have a conversation later.
Yes.
And so maybe the first conversation can go, but I like writing the 400-page draft and then getting it down to 300 pages. That's one of my favorite things to do.
So you mentioned narrative. Now, does narrative come easy to you? Does storytelling come easy?
No, I think that's the hardest part for me.
Really?
Is the plot itself. And so with this novel, you know, I knew that they would be separated, and that 12 years later, you know, Elvia's 15 and she's pregnant, and she's very angry because she doesn't want to have this baby, and so she immediately starts thinking, well, how could my mother have left me? And then I knew that Serafina would be coming back and looking for her, but the plot itself, you know, what was going to happen to them? That's the interesting part for me, but it is the hardest. I like describing things, and I like thinking about how the moths looked or how the parking lot looked. Then I'm not quite sure what's going to happen to them next.
How do you figure out what's going to happen? I mean, do you...
It's 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and I sit there, and they're in the parking lot, and then suddenly, I don't know, this person shows up, and it's a foster, you know, it's a social worker, and he carries her off to a foster home, and it's always got to be like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's completely quiet and dark outside, and suddenly I know what happens. And suddenly Elvia is there picking grapes, and this guy shows up, and he's going to sell her boyfriend, who she thinks is the greatest guy in the world. He's going to sell that guy some speed, and then she's racing down the road suddenly, and her boyfriend is a speed addict. She realizes, wait a minute, my dad's like this, and now I'm with this guy like this. And I'm appalled for her, too. You know, I'm like, oh, man, how did this happen? What are you going to do now? I can't kind of describe it in an intelligent way.
Part of what it seems writers, especially new writers, have problems with is having bad things happen to their favorite characters. And it sounds like you feel bad for them, but you don't stop these things from happening.
No, you can't stop those things from happening. See, I think that's back to your question about why we make it fiction instead of an essay.
Yeah.
Because in fiction, I can sort of just go along for the ride, but I feel like I can change it at some point, maybe. But if I don't change it, nobody's really going to get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
In real life, what's scary? I mean, my brother died in February. Mm-hmm. And my brother, as I'm reading, you know, these pages now, my brother's still alive on the page. But it was just, in the book, the character of Larry, he hooks up with his daughter, and he will find her again. And he seems like an unrelenting force of nature, and, you know, he's listening to AC/DC, and on the way here I was listening to AC/DC, and I was missing my brother. I was thinking of Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap and all the things that my brother and his friends used to do. I mean, I really miss my brother. He's my only genetic twin in the world. And yet I read this, and I think I did change him a little bit in this, and maybe that's the only control I have over anything in my life. When I'm writing fiction. And so you're right. New writers are like, wait a minute, I don't want that to happen to this character. Sometimes you just have to sit back and enjoy the ride. I think that makes your writing better.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Susan Strait, who is going to be at the conference this weekend at UCI, here at UCI. And if you want to know more about it, go to www.asja.org and click on the right side of the screen where it says Take Your Writing Career to the Next Level, and you can read all about it. And she'll be here on Saturday along with other wonderful writers. So if you're listening and you're itching to be among writers and get out of your solitude, come over to UCI on Saturday.
Yeah, a writer's conference is a really good thing to me. People ask me that same question that mm-hmm. you asked about graduate school.
Yeah.
I mean, I taught at Breadloaf Writers Conference this summer.
Yes.
And I have not been to a writer's conference in many, many years. I never actually attended one because I always had all those kids. But Breadloaf was really something. It was really great for me to go hear the craft lectures and hear poets talk about why they do what they do. It was a big inspiration for me to come back after the summer, and it helped me get back to my novel. So, I mean, a writer's conference, like you said, you're sort of immersed in just talking about things like narrative or dialogue for a whole day. I think it's really a good thing.
You know, it is. And as you said, it's not just for new writers who are trying to figure it all out. I think writer's conferences are inspiring for writers at all stages.
Yeah, I was really scared to go to Breadloaf. I was so afraid. It was going to be me and all my kids, and I thought, oh my goodness, everyone's going to sound so much more intelligent than me. And of course they did, but that was all right. I just wanted to absorb.
You're so funny. You've won all these awards. You have all these books. You've been given all this acclaim.
Yeah, and when we gave our craft lectures, and then everybody else was quoting Aristotle and Dostoevsky, and I quoted my mom. Because he told me I was really ugly and I should use my brain and not expect to get married. And that's why I'm a writer.
Oh, that's funny.
That's what happened. So I did feel kind of silly having that be. But I did, what I liked about it was people sitting around a meal talking about why a poem should be in metered verse.
Yeah.
And this is great to hear. It's not something I usually hear in my neighborhood. No. I usually hear, how come you never wash your car? And they write stuff on it.
Well, that's the thing about writers. I'm trying to figure this out because it's like writers, you kind of need other literary types around, at times at least, to share a certain sensibility, whether you get it from, you know, one friend or you're able to go away to a conference or graduate school or whatever. It's, you just need it.
And if you're not in, you know, like you said, if you're not a brand new writer, maybe you're in your 40s or 50s and you're just starting writing now. But I know people swear by their weekly writing workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't have that, but I mean, I have Holly. And she's like the Holly Robinson Writer's Workshop for me. I pay her all the time in food. I send her food all the time. And I thank her in the front of every book, too. Mm. But I just mean, you do have to have somebody else.
Yeah.
And I'm the opposite of most people. I know that. I don't live in Los Angeles. I don't live around a lot of other writers. And I don't talk about writing for most of my waking hours unless I'm at work. But it doesn't mean I don't remember what somebody said at Breadloaf when it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm trying to figure out why I'm still awake or why I'm not watching Matlock, say, like everyone else or something. Why am I sitting here in front of the computer? It's because we have that compulsion, and I heard such things at Breadloaf, and then I remember why I'm doing it.
Mm. What about agents? What's your experience been with agents? And that seems to be a topic we return to again and again on this show. Any advice regarding agents?
It is a difficult topic, but it has to be discussed, right? I've had the same agent all this time, since my oldest one was 6 months old, and she's 13 now.
Hmm.
And he's an independent agent in New York City, and he found me through a friend and also from reading literary magazines. A lot of agents at Breadloaf told me that they read tons of literary magazines and that they're really looking for someone new, and you'd be absolutely shocked by how many of them said they found such and such a short story writer from reading a short story in Zoetrope or reading Psy Quarterly. So, I mean, one thing that I would say to aspiring writers about agents is get your stuff in those literary magazines that people always say you should send to and you don't want to, because agents are really reading those for some fresh new voices. And the thing is, I really do think agents are an integral part of the business, because I don't know those things about contracts. I trust my agent implicitly. Book contracts are extremely complicated. And even short stories and essays, you know, all these essays I've published, if I want to use them later in a book, which people want me to collect the essays, into a book soon, I will have to know whether I can use those essays or not. And agents, they read through that 50 pages of a contract, and that's what they do. And people begrudge them sometimes, and I say I never begrudge a single dollar that I've ever... In fact, I send my agent money if he hasn't done something for some of those essays because he suffered with me through all those short stories. Because I trust him implicitly with everything. There are a lot of great agents out there, and a lot of agents came to Breadloaf, as I said, really looking for something new and something fresh. And that doesn't mean something young. There were lots and lots of people who had just begun their writing careers in their 40s, and they were hooking up with agents at Breadloaf. So I think that the one thing agents do is they navigate those waters that writers do not know how to swim in.
Yeah. Yeah. You think personality is an important part of it in terms of do you mesh with...
I don't know, because I've always had... You know, my agent is so kind to me, and he's like a second father to me. He's always worried that I'm working too hard and staying up too late. But that is a good question. I have heard from other writers that they clash with agents as far as personality or style, and that they've then gone on to find somebody they liked better. I've met writers who've had like four or five agents and just go from person to person. So I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that, because remember, you're talking to somebody who lives three blocks from the hospital where she was born. I would never, ever, ever move away from my house now, and I will never, ever leave my agent. You know, it's like a pathetically loyal thing. But I think that there is a personality issue in that, what if you want to write literary stories and you don't want to be pushed into writing something commercial?
Right.
Those are things to think about. Some agents tend to the more commercial side, and some, like mine, are always willing to take a chance on someone literary.
What about that, the marketplace? Are you cognizant of the marketplace while you're writing? Do you pay attention to it, or are you just writing what you need to write and figure it's going to find a home or it's not?
I think I love to read. You know, when my students are always laughing because I recommend that they read all these literary magazines, and then they think I'm not going to read them, that I'm just telling them. And then I check them all out from the library, you know. I read Tri-Quarterly, I read Plowshares, I read Zoetrope. I like Tin House. That's one of my favorites. One of my favorite magazines is The Sun. It's extremely bleak and depressing. But, boy, you don't forget what you read when you're walking around the rest of the week, you remember. And I recommend my students to send things to specific literary magazines that I think fit them. And I never write a short story with that in mind. And, no, I don't work on a novel thinking I'm going to sell this to a specific, group. But the essays, I'm really good about, you know, trying to read magazines and figuring out where my essays would work or things like that. I love listening to NPR. I listened to NPR for a long, long time before I ever dreamed that I would send something to them. There were things I heard like Bailey White and David Sedaris, and I'd never heard anything like that in my life until I started listening to NPR, you know. And so I think knowing the marketplace is really important. I mean, if people are going to send a short story out to a magazine, they should have read at least four or five issues of that magazine to make sure their work is going to fit there. Novels are a completely different proposition, don't you think? No one can figure out what the novel-buying public wants to read.
Right.
It's the great mystery of life, which is why I think it's so interesting. It's such a challenge. So I write novels, like I said, for that sort of deep, passionate reason, and I'm always just glad if somebody buys it. And, you know, with High Wire Moon... It was something I was just obsessed with, telling this story about this mother and daughter and this dad. And it's really strange now. I mean, I look at the paperback coming out, and I'll be going around this month talking about The Grapes of Wrath and High Wire Moon. All those people still crossing the border. I wrote this 5 years ago. You know, people are still crossing the border, and my brother's not around anymore, but you know, all his friends are. And there are still lots of foster kids. White Oleander was a great novel about some horrible foster homes, but I wanted to write about a couple of good foster homes. So, a lot of foster moms came up to me after readings and said, I never read anything good about foster kids. And I was really happy to read about a nice foster home in your novel. And a lot of women have come up to me and said, I grew up picking grapes in Mecca or in Fresno or in Bakersfield, or my mom grew up picking grapes in Fresno, and that they were really glad to see those characters. So I think I never really think about the marketplace. I'm always just grateful to hear that somebody enjoyed it.
Yes. Well, I can't wait to see you on Saturday. And
I'm supposed to talk about narrative, so yeah. I've got to figure it out. I'll be thinking about that tonight at 2 o'clock in the morning, okay? Narrative. I better sound more intelligent about this now.
No, you've been wonderful. And thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You're
looking
so
forward to Saturday.
Me too. See you then.
See you then.
That was Susan Strait, author of High Wire Moon. There's so much left to talk about, and hopefully on Saturday, we'll hear all of those things that we still are wondering about. She's wonderful, and her writing's wonderful, too. What else can I tell you? We're at the end of the show. If you have comments or questions and would like to know about future guests, go to my website, writersonwriting.com. Sign up to be on the mailing list if you like. Conference again Saturday here at UCI. Susan Strait, Joseph Wamba, Andrew Weiner, Mary Rako, Ron Carlson. Oh, man. So many fiction writers and journalists. Literary agents, Julie Castiglia, Betsy Amster, B.J. Robbins. A ton of people are going to be there. You can find it at asja.org. Click on the right side of the screen. Or I suppose it's up on UCI's website at this point. I'd like to end with a quote by Simone Weil, who said, "Imagination and fiction make up more than 3/4 of our real life." Ain't that the truth? You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening.